Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how to make your garden grow in Phoenix's triple-digit summer temperatures and the role of art in selling the American Southwest in the early part of the 20th century. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The majority party has been kept almost completely in the dark throughout the negotiations of this budget. We were made numerous assurances about things that would be part of this budget and are not now there.
There's people in leadership positions that somehow found themselves there that forgot that when you're in a leadership position, you should also have a spine and you should have the back of your rank and file Democrats.
I'm really proud that we are able to deliver for some of the most vulnerable in our communities, going from the elderly, our tribal communities, students who will be able to have programs for after school. There are so many programs that are in here that I'm truly proud that were funded this year.
I'm not going to budge on this. It's my fiduciary responsibility as the Attorney General to make sure that this money is spent for all Arizonans and not just to backfill the budget of the Department of Corrections.
The Attorney General's characterization of these funds as backfilling the budget of ADCRR could be more accurately described as funding vital opioid use disorder treatment for a population that is disproportionately impacted by the opioid epidemic.
These executive actions by the president is going to keep families intact, keep them together. Benefits them, benefits the state of Arizona.
And joining me to talk about the final budget deal, the continuing controversy over money earmarked for helping treat opioid addiction and more are Matthew Benson of Veritas. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker Jen Longton. Jen, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Matt, let me start with you. A judge in Maricopa County has decided that Attorney General Chris Mays does not have to give a bunch of money from the opioid settlement to backfill money, as she is calling it, to the State Department of Corrections. This seems like it's going to be a pretty protracted fight and could potentially be a big issue if, like, in terms of having a balanced budget, if this money doesn't end up getting transferred.
There's no question. We're talking about $115 million that the state budget calls to be transferred from this national opioid settlement from the AG's office into the general fund, basically, to, as you put it, to help balance the budget. Now, look, I mean, legislators and the governor's office say this money is intended to be used to help deal with opioid issues in the state prison system, of which there are many issues there, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the AG has, you know, countered that this would violate the terms of that settlement. I think, first off, in terms of the budget, it sets up real questions in terms of If this money is not allowed to transfer, then potentially you're going to have to cut $115 million somewhere else to balance the budget. But secondarily, I just think this is a fascinating one more aspect of this budding rivalry between the state's Democratic governor and Democratic attorney general.
Yeah, Jen, it is interesting. I mean, and Chris Mays was very clear early on, once the budget documents were leaked / released, that this was not going to fly with her, that this money in her mind would be illegally transferred. It's not what the money was set up for. It could, as she said, jeopardize future payments from the settlement to Arizona. And she really lobbied pretty hard to get this taken out of the budget. In the end, she wasn't successful there.
Right. I think that, at the top it said something about this money is going to help protect vulnerable people inside our prison population, and I believe that's what that money's there to do. I did go read at least that part of the blurb.
Okay.
I believe that the money will be appropriately spent on substance use disorders, opioid addiction within our prison system, and for those, coming out reentry. And I think it's a great way to spend that money.
So what do you think led to this remaining in the budget after the lobbying effort from Attorney General Mays? I mean, there are other funds presumably that could have been swept or other cuts that could have been made. Why do you think lawmakers and Governor Hobbs decided to stick with this one?
Well, I think it's really hard to do a deficit budget. And they had to make a lot of cuts in a lot of places. You know, more than $1 billion had to be cut out of the budget. And a lot of tough decisions had to be made. I think that they took a look at this and saw that they can take this money and use it inside our prison population to work on opioid issues. It sounds like the right thing to do.
Matt, I want to ask you about opposition. There's bipartisan support, bipartisan opposition to this budget. And I want to put you back in the Wayback Machine to when you were a reporter with the Arizona Republic during the last time we had divided government when Janet Napolitano was governor. I wonder what you see in terms of legislative Democrats and how they felt about their priorities in the budgets that then Governor Napolitano negotiated with Senate President Ken Bennett, House Speaker Jim Wyers, to what legislative Democrats are saying now about the budget negotiated by Katie Hobbs and Ben Thoma and Warren Peterson.
Look, I think under the Napolitano administration, it would have been virtually unheard of to see the sort of public criticism of the Democratic governor that you have seen this session and last session, for that matter. What it means to be a Democrat in this state has changed in a big way in that period of time. This is a very progressive caucus. I think during the Napolitano administration, she was clearly running the show for Democrats in this state. And, you know, that is less so the case at this point. You've got a number of Democratic statewides, including the Attorney General, including the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Folks who are potentially looking at running for governor themselves in 2026. So it's a much more – the power structure is much more diffuse than it ever was under Napolitano. She was the unchallenged leader of the party.
Well, and Jen, it's worth probably noting that the Democratic caucuses in the legislature are bigger now than they were under Governor Napolitano. But, you know, you were a member of that caucus until fairly recently. I'm curious what you make of the fact that some Democratic leaders didn't vote for this budget, that we just heard a moment or two ago a Democratic lawmaker criticizing their leadership and the governor for what was in this budget or what was not in this budget.
Right. Well, with a one vote majority in favor of the Republicans, that is a very tenuous lead. I think that Senator Mendez made a great statement on the floor as he was getting ready to vote, talking about how long he's been there and that folks who think that they were going to negotiate better than the governor did do that. And I'm paraphrasing, but somewhat from a position of naivete. Others might call it hubris to say that they weren't going to go in and negotiate as hard as the governor did. I don't know that, you know, a member of Democratic leadership was going to cut a better deal than the governor did.
Do you feel, having read what you have of the budget, mm-hmm. do you feel like it was a good deal for Democrats?
Again, like everyone else, this is a deficit budget. And when you look at it, I think that, the adage is if we all come out of there equally unhappy, we did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
I am happy with it. You know, I'm happy that, for example, Arts, DD and Area Agency on Aging were all going to be cut down to zero. Each one of them saw $2 million, which is something that I think is very helpful. I think that they made some good compromises on education and healthcare. And certainly, you know, the SAFE Act along the border is something I strongly support.
Matt, on the Republican side, we know that a number of members of the Arizona Freedom Caucus were not impressed with this budget. They didn't vote for it and were pretty critical of especially Senate President Warren Peterson over this. Do you think this is a good deal on the Republican side?
I think it's very similar to the Democrats in terms of the grousing among some of the members of the Republican caucus, the Freedom Caucus you mentioned, but not just the far right. I mean, I think Matt Gress voted against this budget. You know, not a Freedom Caucus member, considered more center of the party.
Who was a budget director under former Governor Ducey.
Absolutely. Yeah. So again, like as Jen pointed out, I mean, bipartisan budgets kind of give everybody something to hate. That's just the nature of the beast.
All right. So, Jen, we mentioned that the Democratic caucus is bigger now than it was under Governor Napolitano. Governor Hobbs has clearly made it a point to try to win control of one or both of the legislative chambers. And to that end, the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee said this week that it would be allocating $10 million for legislative campaigns as part of a summer program. Mm-hmm. This is something that Democrats have been talking about basically forever. I mean, at least as long as I've been here, about flipping one or both of the legislative chambers. Is this the year? I mean, that's sort of the perennial question here, right? Is this the year?
I'd like to believe it. You know, I chaired the ADLCC, the Arizona Democratic mm-hmm. Legislative Campaign Committee, for a couple of years, stayed very involved until my retirement from the legislature, and then the bylaws don't allow me to stay within the organization. I'd like to see every one of those $10 million come here. Arizona is the swing state, I think. And I think what's really important for an organization like that to remember is when you activate those state legislative races, there is no like up-ticket drop-off. If you activate those races, Senate, President, have a stronger pathway through our state. So I think that I'd like to see more of those national organizations looking at Arizona through that lens.
Does it hurt some of those efforts, though? I mean, we've seen poll after poll that show former President Trump leading President Biden in Arizona. Does that hurt that effort if the top of the ticket is maybe not going the way that Democrats want it to go?
I'm trying to just stay focused on what's happening in the state legislature, because one seat ties it in either chamber. Had there been a tie, we wouldn't have seen 2060 make it to the ballot and lots of these other
initiatives. The border
security measure. We wouldn't have seen this initiative on judges so that if they are voted out, they'll still get to stay in office, nullifying that. That wouldn't have made it to the ballot. So I'm just going to stay really focused on the state legislature. If I look elsewhere, I'll lose energy for what I need to do.
Matt, what do you think? I mean, there's a handful of swing districts in this state, in the legislature. Is there a realistic possibility that Democrats could potentially take one or both of the legislative chambers, you think?
Well, of course there's a possibility. I mean, look, I've been following closely the Arizona legislature since 2006, same as yourself.
Yeah.
Every cycle since then, Democrats have thought they had an opportunity to take one or both chambers, especially kind of in recent years. It hasn't happened yet. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen this year, but I think it's always an uphill battle for Democrats. There have been some key resignations and folks not running for offices that Democrats expected were going to. It's going to make it a more uphill fight, but it's certainly possible.
Do Republicans from the national perspective, is there the same – I guess, financial commitment, the same attention on the Arizona legislature as there seems to be from the Democratic side?
Well, I don't think we've seen some of the pledges of national money to support some of these legislative races on the right that you're seeing on the left. But you know, it's only June.
Thanks for reminding us. Let's go to an election. We have an election coming up. Still talking about the election from a couple of years ago. A judge this week, Matt, tossed attempted to dismiss a case against two Cochise County supervisors. They had been indicted by a grand jury that Attorney General Chris Mays was prosecuting. So this means it's going to go to trial. It sounds like it's going to be one kind of interesting trial.
Yeah, I think this is just, another aspect of the legal difficulties, the legal situation facing not just those supervisors in Cochise County, but the fake electors and the other folks facing investigations. So you're absolutely right. I think it is going to be fascinating, and hopefully it serves to dissuade similar activities this cycle and in future cycles involving county officials that decide they're just going to hold up certification for, political reasons.
I'm not sure that we know quite yet the timeline on this, but if this trial is happening around the time, let's say, maybe October-ish, early November, does it have any impact on the way people vote, do you think?
I don't think it affects how people vote necessarily, but again, I think it potentially serves as a reminder to those county officials across Arizona's 15 counties about their responsibilities and the legal peril they face if they decide to ignore the responsibility in front of them.
Jen, we've seen the Biden administration, for example, with commercial after commercial about referencing January 6th, referencing former President Trump's refusal to acknowledge the results of the 2020 election. Does a trial like this happening in Arizona, you mentioned this is a big swing state, does that sway anybody? Does it have any kind of impact on the 2024 election, do you think?
You know, I think I'm a little cynical about that. I think that part's kind of baked. People believe what they believe, and the outcome of this isn't going to change it. Matt, I'm not sure that this is going to cause county officials to say, oh, I could get in legal trouble if I don't follow the rules. I think for some of these folks, it's a badge of honor to do so. It's going to be fascinating to watch this play out.
Yeah, I think that is a fair assessment. So speaking of southern Arizona, and specifically in this case, the border, President Biden this week announced additional protections for spouses of some undocumented spouses and some others of folks who are in the country. Jen, this is sort of following up on his asylum rules he put into place, basically shutting off the asylum system for some amount of time. There's been a lot of cynicism, a lot of criticism of the president of, like, why are you doing this now as opposed to basically any time in the previous 3.5 years? What do you think of that argument?
Why are you doing this now instead of any time in the past 3 years? Certainly, I looked at the announcement and said, you know, finally, there's a lot of work to do on the border, and it has to come through the federal government. I'm really happy with this particular action. I know a lot of people who are impacted by it. And I think the other piece that we're not talking about enough is the part that's going to allow especially like kids headed for college right now or finishing high school who are too young to have gotten DACA, to have become DACA recipients, those young people, as they leave school, can legally get jobs in the United States. And I think that's going to be important. So I'm pleased that we're finally there, and I want to see a lot more.
Matt, is it too cynical to suggest that this is President Biden trying to walk that fine line between looking like he's doing something on the border but also trying to shore up a part of his base?
Of course it's not too cynical. I mean, this is politics. It's an election year. Everybody understands that the border and illegal immigration generally are arguably the president's biggest vulnerability outside of maybe inflation. Biden is trying to triangulate on this issue. I mean, it was a number of weeks ago he announced, you know, asylum reforms, mm-hmm. stronger rules, trying to cut down on the wave of illegal immigrants coming over the border and basically gaming the asylum system in this country. And then, you know, he took a lot of heat for that on the left and then primarily. And then now he's come back around and said, OK, I'll grant, you know, legal status to this 500,000 people who are in this population that is the most sympathetic. We're talking about spouses who are married to somebody in the country legally and who've been here for at least 10 years. And as Jen pointed out, and, you know, certain population of their children, dreamers, basically, but those that were, you know, particularly young at that, you know, when DACA was issued. And so, again, like, I think he's trying to sort of triangulate this issue and thread that needle. Is it possible? We're going to find out. I mean, we're going to find out. But I think that's the politics are at play here.
Jen, you mentioned DACA, and it's worth noting that DACA is still the subject of litigation. Its future mm-hmm. is not secure at this point, nor presumably if somebody challenges this new executive action, because it is an executive order, not a law passed by Congress. Does that impact at least the impact on the people that it's aiming to impact? I hate to keep using the word impact, but the fact that all of this it could go away, you know, sort of at a moment's notice based on an election, the results of an election or a judge's ruling.
I'm not a fan of governing through executive order. I think they're important, used well, but they can be reversed by the next executive or the one after that. Again, this is an issue that we need Congress to work with the president to come up with a solution. We were so close to getting this done until it was politicized for the presidential election by the other guy. I think with there, we could get this done. We know what to do. It just takes political wherewithal to get it done. Just takes political wherewithal to get it done.
That seems like a big, that's a big just.
It is a big just these days. It shouldn't be so hard to make the right choices.
Matt, Governor Hobbs this week made an announcement that I think everybody saw coming, which is that she's going to appeal the ruling in the case about her trying to go around the Senate to appoint directors of state agencies. Talked about the Cochise County. That could be a really interesting trial. This one could also be potentially interesting and far-reaching depending on what the outcome is, right?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, look, you've got this standoff between the governor and the legislature in terms of these directors running state agencies because, you know, of course, the legislature kind of set up this committee that blocked a lot of the governor's directors for the longest time, for forever. Basically, whoever was named governor sort of was able to put in charge of these state agencies who they deemed fit. And the legislature had this process to approve them. But we had never seen previously the situation where they were being just blocked basically almost as a group. And so this court decision, how this appeal plays out, I think is really going to be impactful for certainly this administration, but all administrations going forward, anytime you have divided government, which I think is going to be a feature in the state of Arizona for a number of years.
Jen, we talked about the efforts to flip the legislature. Is this the kind of issue that the governor and Democratic candidates can run on, or is it maybe too far in the weeds for voters to really understand and care about?
Oh, I think you can pull out the important parts of this that voters can and will care about. And I want to go back to something Matt just said. It's not a standoff between the governor and the legislature. It's an issue with a couple of Freedom Caucus senators. And, you know, we do have a separation of powers. When I served under a Republican governor, I would often remind folks that we are co-equal branches of government. The governor oversees the agencies, and the governor's picks to run those agencies shouldn't be subject to the kind of witch hunt. I'm trying to think of a better – I don't have a neutral term for
it. There were deep investigations, I think,
is what
Senator Hoffman
called them.
We will
go with deep investigations that weren't even necessarily relevant to their abilities to run the organizations that they were chosen to run. The reason the appointment process exists and has existed for forever is to prevent some cronyism, right? So you can't just put your brother in charge of whatever – and, you know, your brother can run a gas station but not the Department of Corrections, right? Mm-hmm. And that has not been what DINO has set out to do.
That's the committee that was set up to vet these candidates. Matt, in the last, like, 30 seconds or so we have, is this a useful issue for Governor Hobbs to be able to say, look, I'm fighting the Republicans in the legislature. This is why we have to flip the legislature. If
no.
you're Governor Hobbs.
No.
Voters don't care?
No.
No, you don't think the obstruction
nope. –
I mean, at every door I've knocked on, they want you to stop the gridlock, and they see this as one of those issues.
I don't believe it.
No?
Nope.
Okay.
I think voters care about the kitchen table issues, inflation, illegal immigration, health care, good schools. I don't think many voters are following closely who's running Department of Child Safety or – any of these state agencies.
All right.
Can we
well,
get another 20 minutes?
I wish. We'll have you back, I promise. That is Matt Benson, Jen Longton. Thank you both for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a Flagstaff museum curator explains how art was used in the late 19th century to promote travel to the Southwest. But first, a few years ago, master gardener Melissa Cruz People showed us around her garden in the heat of summer and told us all that we can, in fact, grow a whole lot, even in Metro Phoenix, even in the sweltering summer heat. But these last two summers have been different. The heat in the Valley of the Sun has intensified, breaking records and burning up even native plants. But Cruz People's is still gardening. My co-host Lauren Gilger went back out to her home garden recently to see how it's going.
So we are standing in your garden, in your front yard. You have several gardens. This is just the front one. Right. It's getting hotter, but it's not incredibly hot yet. And I mean, let's talk a little bit about what's working so far this summer. What are you growing? Let's see.
Yeah, so in spring in Phoenix, started in late February. So I still have some zucchini, my tomatoes, peppers. Those will live. And eggplant is thriving. It loves the heat. And then I have lots of flowers, zinnias, and I still have parsley and oregano and lemon balm and all the herbs that'll live through the summer. They may look a little crispy, but I can cut those back at the end of summer and those will be great. So there's still a lot thriving and growing well.
So far, at least, you know, mid-June-ish, it's still going okay.
Yeah, it's still going okay. So we're still getting all these big harvests from our spring plantings. And that wouldn't be the case if we planted, like, in April when most of the country considers it spring. Those things wouldn't ever reach their full potential. But because we consider spring, like, late February, those things are really their height is kind of the end of May. Yeah. And so they're kind of tapering off. But still getting quite a bit of stuff every week from the garden.
That's amazing. What are these purple flowers? These are so beautiful. They look like roses.
They do look like roses. So this is called Lysianthus, and I'm going to cut some here. And so they're
beautiful.
Like a cut flower, and they just are gorgeous. And it's like 110, and look at this beautiful.
I know. How are they surviving this?
Yeah, so some things, it's just good genes, right? They have the genes and the genetics to survive. So some flowers are, you know, drying up and not doing well because they don't love the heat. They love 70 degrees. Yeah. And so planting the right thing when really helps.
And you, I'm sure, look at where things go in the garden, what needs shade some parts of the day, what can handle the heat of the, I mean, when it's 110 and they're getting fried, what can survive that?
Okra and melons, they can be full sun and survive that and don't need any shade. Tomatoes and peppers, on the other hand, need some shade. And so my pepper patch over here, I haven't set up shade yet, but I really need to, because those, all these little fruits, you can see what happens is then they start to get a sunburn just like us. They'll get sort of, oh, and here's one you can kind of see where it gets all soft.
That's what the sunburn looks like.
And so giving it a little shade will help.
All right, you want to head around the back?
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got a lot growing back here. Is this onions you're harvesting?
Yeah, so these are these little e-toy onions or like a wild shallot. And so I'm letting those dry. And then you plant one and you get like 20.
Oh, wow.
You get this whole bunch. And so when they're green, we eat them all winter and chop them up like green onions. And so these I'm largely saving for replanting at the end of summer. But I want to show you, I'm going to grab this giant eggplant under here. This is an Italian one.
Oh, that's a big one, yeah.
Yeah, and so this is my favorite. It's a purple and white Rosa Bianca eggplant.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so we'll make eggplant parmesan with the tomato sauce, with the herbs, and so a whole meal all from the garden.
So, I mean, when I was here a couple summers ago, it was very rich, full of stuff.
Yeah.
You kind of preached the gospel of you can garden in summer in Phoenix. But it's changing, it sounds like.
Right. The last few years, I mean, because we're not getting the monsoon, too. And even if we don't get a lot of rain, we'd get the clouds and just that relief. And so when we don't get that, there's no break. And so it's getting harder and harder to do the summer garden.
So it's the break from the sun that's the hardest on the plants, not the consistently over 110?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of plants like will stop growing new leaves once we reach about 105. They'll just kind of go dormant. And so it's also the temperature too, because at night, if it never dips below 100, like those plants never get a break. And so even native desert plants like barrel cacti, they won't photosynthesize if it's above 100.
Will they die or will they just wait?
So they die.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, I mean, they can't breathe essentially. And so vegetables and plants are the same. But the key is to look for those varieties and those things, those genetics that have adapted are more likely to survive the heat waves and direct sun.
And that's these plants that you're showing us today.
Yeah, and so like a lot of melons and watermelons have great genetics that survive.
You've got a lot back here, yeah.
Yeah, and so I kind of, knowing it's so hot, went all in with my melon patch this year.
So this is all, this whole garden bed is melons?
Just this side. Okay. And then I want to do corn later in the summer, but I don't want the soil to just die for the next few months. So I planted a cover crop.
What are you planted here?
And so these are cowpeas. This is a Tohono O'odham variety of cowpea. Mm-hmm. A lot of people know cowpeas as like black-eyed peas.
Yeah, yeah.
So southern peas, originally from Africa, thrive in the heat and sun. And so I'm not going to grow these for their peas. I'm just growing them for like a mulch. Mm-hmm. And then in late July, August, depending on how the weather's looking, I'll basically cut those and mix it into the soil.
Yeah.
And then I'll plant my corn. And so it's adding green fertilizer and nutrients, and it's keeping the soil alive. And then I keep it watered just so all the bacteria and microbes and living things in the soil don't bake and dry.
So if you do let your garden bed kind of die all summer, you don't do anything to it, it's all super dry in the fall when you want to plant again, what do you do to bring it back? Can you bring it back?
Yeah, it's basically dead. You've killed all the microorganisms.
So dirt can die?
Yeah, exactly. That's what dirt is alive. It's got all kinds of living organisms. And so it's not bringing the nutrients to. And so it'll be a very slow start, but you'll have to add in fertilizer, more organic matter, and things to bring that soil back to life.
You're not giving up on summer gardening in Phoenix quite yet?
Not quite yet, no. So just adjusting and doing more of the things that I know will survive.
So are there any, we can go in the shade here, it's getting hot. We're sweating now. Are there any desert plants that have normally and traditionally done well here that are just kind of not able to survive these summers anymore the way they are, in the city at least?
Yeah, I would say we saw that last year with saguaro sort of die off, and agaves are struggling. But some of it is they're having disease and fungal issues and pests that just are exacerbated. So if you're stressed out from the heat and, you know, fluctuating heat and then never really getting a break, those diseases and bugs and pests are even just more of a problem. And so we saw a lot of really die off of native plants.
So that's a shame and kind of a huge loss in a lot of ways. But I wonder this, because you keep talking about plants that are adapted to the heat. Do you think as the city gets hotter, and it seems like it will, are there going to be more and more plants that are adapted to that kind of extreme heat?
Yeah, and that's what it's the scale and pace of evolving. And so if our heat effects are going at such a rapid pace, those plants need generations to evolve and adapt. And so they're kind of lagging behind sort of the pace and acceleration of climate change. So, you know, that's what they say, we might just run out of time. And so that's what's great about people who are working on breeding different things and investing in saving seeds and working on those things that are adapted. And I try to do that in my own garden. So a lot of the things that maybe look a little ugly at this point are lettuce varieties that are really heat adapted. And I'm harvesting lettuce into March and April. And so I'm saving seeds from those.
So you're letting them go to seed and then save.
So those are good genetics I want to save and let those varieties continue.
You're aiding the natural selection here.
Exactly. And so you can do that, you know, at a bigger, longer term scale with native plants that are perennials and live for years, or these annuals, and try to keep those genes going.
There's a glimmer of hope in that. I'll take it.
Exactly. Yeah. So we can work together. And you know, as gardeners, we choose what we get to plant. And looking at a lot of these more local and locally adapted plants will help.
Melissa Cruz Peoples, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
That was my co-host Lauren Gilger speaking with Melissa Cruz Peoples, master gardener, teacher, and program coordinator of the Garden Commons at ASU's Polytechnic campus. You can find her and all of her gardening tips on Instagram at The Desert Smells Like Veggies. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. An exhibit at the Museum of Northern Arizona in Flagstaff explores the art used to promote travel to the Southwest in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Much of it was related to the Santa Fe Railway and Fred Harvey Company, and showed a part of the country that many Americans had never seen before. Alan Peterson says the exhibit came about as he was looking to rebuild the museum's exhibit schedule after COVID and wanted to draw from its fine art collection. He wondered how many of the artists in the museum's collection produced work for the Santa Fe Railway in the early 20th century. The answer, it turns out, is far more than he expected. Peterson is curator of fine arts at the Museum of Northern Arizona and the curator of the Selling the Southwest exhibit, which will be on display here, there through January of next year. He joins me to talk more about it. And Alan, this is a time in American history and artwork that really relates to this part of the country and Northern Arizona specifically.
It is. And I've always loved this, like I said, this era, but also just that whole milieu that was taking place here in the Southwest, from New Mexico to Southern California. And it was a very rich period, and really interest in the Southwest had begun to grow in a pretty significant way before the Santa Fe, had decided to start using artwork to promote their route out here.
How did the Santa Fe Railroad try to market the Southwest? Like, what kinds of images did they use? What kinds of maybe thoughts were they trying to evoke to convince people to come out here?
So the predecessors, let me just mention them briefly. So predecessors, people who had written about or done artwork about the Southwest, date back to the artists who had worked with John Wesley Powell in his survey of the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end of the 19th century, a writer named Charles Loomis published a couple of books. And so those books writings and poetry by Mary Austin and other, writers, Frederick Remington was really big at that time in American art. And I think that the Santa Fe recognized the power of the visual image. So one of their marketing directors had the idea to invite Thomas Moran, the landscape painter, who was, again, really big in American art at that time, invited Moran to the Grand Canyon. And the painting that Moran did on that visit was used in some promotional materials. The Santa Fe didn't acquire that painting, but beginning in 1903, they did begin to build a collection. And in doing so, built a large collection of over 500 works, but also built on the mystery and the mystique and the ancient cultures that lived here in the Southwest.
I'm interested in that era of mystery that you talked about, because obviously at that time, like, this was not a place that some majority of Americans had been to. So it almost seems like it was the kind of thing where the railway could kind of create the image that it wanted to, almost define the area before anybody else had the chance to, at least people who are coming here from somewhere else, of course, not people who are already living here or Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Like I said, I think they saw the opportunity. They knew they had a great product. And, along with the Fred Harvey Company, who then established restaurants and hotels along the Santa Fe route, they could provide, the complete package. And as I said earlier, they had, fantastic landscapes that they could use in that artists would portray in landscapes, but then depictions of Native Americans. And all that visual imagery was very idealized. And people came to accept it. Their customers, the public in general, came to accept that image of the Southwest. And really, it persists to this day.
Yeah, I mean, do you draw a direct line from some of this artwork to the way that people have seen the Southwest throughout history?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you go into any of the galleries certainly Santa Fe, New Mexico, Albuquerque, any of the galleries here in Flagstaff, you see work that in some cases looks like it could have been done during that period of time, 100 years ago. But then there are modern representations that are, addressing the same subjects, but with a more, contemporary approach to the subjects.
Right. What was the contribution of Native artists? I mean, were they included in some of this marketing? And if so, was it by choice or were they compelled to do it?
Well, surprisingly, yes, they were included. Native people benefited. Well, it was a mixed blessing. I have to preface what I'm going to say. They, as in many cases around the country and the world, the indigenous people enjoyed a mixed blessing from this interaction and the transactions that they were able to, achieve. So when the railroad first arrived in the Southwest, in the 1880s, Native people were able to sell art directly to travelers from the station platforms. So that was a great direct, you know, way of sales that they could, you know, that they could do, make. And really remarkably, and I learned this in the course of working on this exhibition, is a number of Native artists did sell work to the railroad that became part of their collection.
Hmm.
The funny thing is, though, I haven't dug deeply enough to see how that work was used, if in fact maybe it was ever used in promotional materials.
Yeah. It seems like it might have been kind of a double-edged sword for at least some Native Americans, in the sense that, yes, they were able to sell their artwork, but that artwork, as you say, to the extent that it was used in the marketing efforts, was potentially used to bring people out here who weren't necessarily all that kind or respectful to the to those mm-hmm. people, to those Native Americans.
No, and in fact, there are there are some pretty funny, sad stories of, you know, things that illustrate that.
Well, so when you look at this exhibition as a whole, do you still see elements of how people think about the Southwest in the way that it was being marketed in the earlier part of the 20th century?
Oh, yes. I think that if you were to look at the work in the exhibition, you'd recognize some specific landmarks. I mean, certainly the Grand Canyon,
yeah,
the San Francisco Peaks here in Flagstaff. But there are also, you know, a number of kind of generic, you know, unidentified locations in the Southwest here and northern Arizona that might not be identifiable as a specific location. But most people, certainly in the United States, would immediately recognize it as being in the Southwest. And I think that's actually one of the things, too. I mean, you know, I use the word mystery and mystique. And yes, the audience for this was people primarily on the East Coast. You know, so what did they know about the West at that time? They knew Frederick Remington. They knew a couple of other artists. They knew dime store, you know, cowboy novels, mm-hmm. Cowboys and Indians, that kind of thing. And of course, movies were coming out then, too. But the landscapes are almost otherworldly. And I think that the power of the expanse of the landscape here, coupled with landscape formations and a geography that was completely foreign to anybody, you know, certainly east of the Mississippi. And I think that that would have been viewed as not only mysterious, but also potentially threatening might be too big of a word, but, you know, certainly not a comfortable landscape.
Hmm.
And, you know, I think that people are to some degree enticed by things that might offer a little bit of danger, as long as there's safety to be had while experiencing that.
All right. That is Alan Peterson, curator of fine arts at the Museum of Northern Arizona, also curator of the Selling the Southwest exhibition. Alan, it was nice to talk to you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Whistle down a line. I figure that it's engine number 49. She's the only one that'll sound that way on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. Don't forget, follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And if you've heard a song you liked on today's show, maybe this little ditty about trains, you can now follow us on Spotify. Search KJZZ's The Show on the app. You'll find all the music we have played last month. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and our reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. Chugga, 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 chugga. Ooh.
chugga-chugga-chugga. Let her rip, let her rip, Mr. Engineer. Gotta go far away from here. While the man at the fire shovels on the coal. Stick your head out the cab, watch the drivers roll, see the town.